Blog Talk.
Hello, this is episode number 2 of Caveman Radio. Thanks for tuning in. And what we're going to be talking about tonight is Christopher McDougall's book, Born to Run. I think that this is probably one of my favorite books that I've read in the last couple of years, and that's saying a lot. I read probably a book a week, and if I'm traveling, as many as 2 books a week. So to say that one book is that big of a deal is saying a lot for me. So what I want to do, I'll give you a little bit of a rundown on how this is going to go, and we'll see how it unfolds. What I want to do first, for some of the people that I know, a lot of people who have heard about this book and haven't had a chance to read it yet. So what I want to do is give a little bit of information about the book. I don't want to give away the entire thing, but give you a little bit of a context for what we're going to talk about tonight. And then I'll go from there into the all of the arguments related to the running shoe industry, because there's a big part of the book that has a lot to do with that. And it's not necessarily, I think that some people look at it and think that it's yet another fad, the idea that the shoe industry has caused a lot of problems, and I'll get into that in the second part. And then what I'll do is go into the third part will be the evolutionary side of this, which is obviously near and dear to my heart, being the where do we get the idea that human beings are born to run? And that's a big part of what Christopher McDougall talks about in the book, so I want to definitely spend some time on that. And then if there's time at the end, I'd like to expand the conversation beyond just running and talk about the idea that maybe all of these things that we do, that we add to our lives, are taking away from our ability to enjoy life. If we're masking some of our humanity. I won't tell you everything that we're going to talk about at that point, but I can definitely at least say this. This won't be a conversation where, you know, we need to get back to our roots and we need to all be living a tribal kind of life. I don't believe that. And I think that there's a balance that we need to find. So that's the part that we'll get to at the end, and hopefully we'll have enough time to do that. Just a couple of housekeeping notes here to get started. If you want to participate in the show, you've obviously connected to it via my Blog Talk Radio page, so you can see the call-in number there, but I'll go ahead and say it. It's 347-945-5419. And what I'd like to do is have you, if you call in, what I can see on the little switchboard that they give me here is a phone number. I'm not going to know, based upon that phone number, who it is that's calling in. And what I'd like to do is have anybody that wants to call in go ahead and call that number and then send me an email to EC, that's like Enlightened Caveman, at enlightenedcaveman.com. In the subject line, put your phone number so I can connect the dots there. And then in the body of the email, just give me a quick synopsis on what you want to talk about. And hopefully that will work as far as screening is concerned. I think I might have to get somebody to help me do some screening pretty soon, but for now, we'll see. We'll see what happens. So let's get started with the book. The premise of the book, and the thing that McDougall says was his reason for writing the book, was he was looking for an answer to the question, why does my foot hurt? And apparently, you know, he's a 6'4", 230-pound guy, and he's always wanted to run. He's a journalist and has been all over the place for magazines like Outside Magazine and Men's Health, and he's been assigned to lots and lots of very interesting types of things, everything from war zones to extreme types of sports and things like that. So here's a guy who definitely is an athletic type guy, and he always wanted to be a runner, and for whatever reason, every time he would get up to a certain level of mileage, he would get injured. He would have foot problems, he would have shin problems, And at the time he started investigating what became Born to Run, he was having problems with his foot. And so he wanted an answer to, why does my foot hurt? And he did what I think any of us would do, is he went to the doctor and he went to see orthopedic surgeons. And he, by virtue of the job that he has, had access to some of the biggest names in sports medicine, and he went to see all of them. And across the board, he would ask them, what's my problem? And they'd say, you're too big. You're too big to run. You need to ride a bike. And so he didn't really think that that was a very good answer, and I can relate to that. I don't think I would be very happy to hear something like that either. So he kept investigating, and what he did was look into stories of cultures that have runners, long-distance runners, people who have been doing this for, you know, forever, hundreds of years. And he stumbled across stories about this tribe of Indians in Copper Canyon, Mexico, known as the Tarahumara, and they were rumored to be the fastest long-distance runners on Earth. And so he set off on a quest to find them and to figure out what their secrets are. Maybe that was going to be an answer to his question of, why does my foot hurt? And maybe there would be some way that he could find that would allow him to run. And he just wanted to be able to run. And I can definitely relate to that. So what he did was he went down to Copper Canyon, and over the course of the book, he managed to meet some people from the Tarahumara, and he also managed to meet a guy, an American, who had been living down there with them for years and had adopted their methods of running and had befriended them and really tried to learn from their culture. The guy went by the name Caballo Blanco, or White Horse, and he was somewhat of a mythical figure at the beginning of the book because people talked about him, but he couldn't find the guy. And then when he finally found the guy and got to know him a little bit, he discovered that the guy wanted to create an ultramarathon race in Copper Canyon that would pit the Tarahumara against some of the best ultramarathoners in the United States. And so this is kind of the backdrop for the story that is woven through the entire book, and it's an amazing story because he goes into background on people that had tried to do this before, people who took these groups of these Tarahumara Indians up to Colorado to the Leadville 100, which is a 100-mile trail race that is over a couple of mountains, and it's 50 miles out. You climb these two mountains and then 50 miles back climbing the very same two mountains, and it's grueling. It's an amazingly difficult race, and he talks about how a guy who was definitely the exploiter type who came down there and promised them, you know, very little to get them to come up and do this race. And these are, according to McDougall, very, very nice, shy, you know, simple people. And they decided to do this because they were in a drought and needed the food that was being promised to them. And they went up to this race, and they did this a couple of times. And at one point, they blew everyone away. They won the race hands down. They took, I think, four of the top five slots. And so, you know, thus began America's interest in the Tarahumara. Unfortunately, the situation didn't really go that well for them after the race, and they kind of walked away from it with a bad taste in their mouth and didn't go back. But McDougall, nevertheless, talks about the stories of these people and then talks about some of the current ultra runners in the United States, some people who have some very interesting personalities, and talked about the idea of them coming down to Copper Canyon and participating in this ultra marathon. So again, that's the story that is woven through this. And it's a tremendous story, but McDougall does a great job of putting pieces into the story that are a lot more factual, a lot more nonfiction kind of story. Like, you know, the story itself seems kind of like a fiction story in the way that it's written, but it's real. So I guess it's more of a memoir, but there are bits and pieces of it that are very informative, that have a lot to do with the history of the shoe industry and have a lot to do with evolution and have a lot to do with a lot of different angles on running. And as I pointed out at the very beginning, there's definitely a commentary on the shoe industry in this, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But that's kind of the gist of the book. Now, when I read this book, I was coming at it from a very an interesting place. So about a year ago, little more than a year ago, about a year ago last week, I broke my leg in a skateboarding accident. I was trying to drop into a bowl at a skate park near my house, and it was one of the first times that I had ever done it, and I did it wrong and turned my foot backwards and broke my tibia and fibula pretty badly. The accident was definitely a terrible thing in my life from the standpoint of I have a couple of little kids, and being on crutches for 10 weeks and having major surgery didn't really do well for my family life by any means. And on top of that, it was just it shut down everything that I had been doing. So I've always been a cyclist, more of a cyclist than anything, but I've always been a runner. I've done a lot of adventure racing. And so to me, being sidelined to that extent was something that had never happened to me before, and it was really tough. After I went through the kind of, I would say, the first phase of rehab, which is getting myself off of crutches and being able to walk again, after a couple of more months, I was cleared to ride a bike, and so I got back on my bike, and I spent a lot of time cycling. I put in several thousand miles over the course of the year, but long about September, I was starting to get to the point where my doctor claimed that I would be cleared to run. And right as this was starting to happen, I found out about Born to Run. So I got the book, and I read it, and it was such a page-turner for me, and I loved it. And what I decided, you know, as I closed the book was, okay, I'm going to rehab myself as a midfoot striker. So midfoot striker being contrary to heel striking, which is what most people do when they run. It's certainly what I had always done. So landing on your heel out in front of your body with a big long stride, as opposed to midfoot or forefoot striking, where you land really under your body and you take small steps. So having read the book, I bought into it completely, and I did a lot of research on other things related to barefoot running and things like that, and it all seemed to make really good sense to me. So I got into it, and when I first started running, the first thing I did coming off of the book was I sought out a coach that was mentioned, the guy basically who coached Christopher McDougall. He mentioned the guy in the book. I Googled him, and I found that he had a website that was more of a social network for people. It was called runningwitheric.com. His name is Eric Orton. And so I got in touch with Eric Orton, started checking out his blog and his social media site, and I discovered that, you know, this was the thing for me, and what I was going to do was teach myself to run in this new way. You know, my thinking was I haven't been able to run for 8+ months, so I don't have any muscles built up. I don't have anything to stop doing, as in stop heel striking. I'm starting from ground zero. So what better thing, you know, what better time to do to take on something new than to do it in that case? So what happened was I am frequently afflicted with what I would call acute idiocy, which is I don't heed warnings that I should. And so I went out and I bought myself the most minimalist pair of shoes that I could find. They were a pair of ASICS Piranhas, and they're really track shoes, and there's nothing to them. I mean, literally a little piece of rubber, a little bit of cloth. They weigh almost nothing. And they're the most comfortable shoes I've ever put on my feet. I mean, there was just nothing to them. And so I started running, and I was following a program that I bought off of Eric's website. He had a strength-building program, an 8-week strength-building program. And the program is meant to take somebody who has been either a heel striker for years and years, or somebody who has not really been much of a runner, and slowly help them develop the ability to run and run in the right way, run with the right form. So it's a combination of strength training and a combination of smaller, or I guess starting small and then growing into larger and larger, or longer and longer workouts. But the idea being that after 8 weeks of this, you'll develop the strength that you need in order to be able to run within this new way. Well, sometimes I'm an idiot and sometimes I don't exactly follow instructions. And so I felt pretty good in the first couple of weeks of doing this. And I was running in these ASICS Piranhas, which, you know, were as close to running barefoot as you can get, unless you're running in those Vibram five fingers, which we can talk about in a bit. But I started running in these, and I started picking up my mileage and picking it up faster and doing more than what was called for in the workouts. And it wasn't long before I wouldn't say I fully injured myself, but I would say that I got to the point where I was limping home from my runs, and then I'd wake up the next morning and limp for the next couple of hours and was taking Advil on a very regular basis. And, you know, essentially I hurt myself. I took it too far. And so I learned a really important lesson there that I definitely want to send out as part of this, and I hope that I'll get this out several times in the course of this, which is to say that if you are a heel striker and you're interested in developing a midfoot strike or developing a forefoot strike, it's something that you do not have the muscles to do out of the gates. And it takes weeks to develop muscle, and it takes months to develop connective tissues like tendons. So the idea of running as a heel striker, what happens is you are not using a lot of the muscles from your knee down that you need in order to run in this different way. And so the cautionary note here is, if you think this is interesting and you want to do this, please listen when I say, don't overdo it. Take it very, very slowly. However you have to do that, if you're already a heel striker and you already run a lot, then try to do just a few minutes in each run using the different form, and then eventually you'll build up. But if you try to go out, if you're a 10K, you know, you go out for 10K training runs as a heel striker, and you try to go out and run a 10K as a, you know, not on your heel, running it midfoot or forefoot, there's a high likelihood that you're going to injure yourself. So there's that warning. Now, I do want to say a little bit about Eric, and I'll quote from the book here, because he's a really, really great resource for this. And, you know, and I have a huge appreciation for what he's doing, because he's really, you know, trying to get this concept out there that natural born running is something that everybody can do. So what McDougal has to say about him is the following. He says, as an adventure sports coach in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and the former fitness director for the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center, Eric's specialty is tearing endurance sports down to their integral movements and finding transferable skills. He'd study rock climbing to find shoulder techniques for kayakers and apply Nordic skiing smooth propulsion to mountain biking. What he's really looking for are basic engineering principles. He's convinced that the next great advance in fitness will come not from training or technology, but technique. The athlete who avoids injury will be the one who leaves the competition behind. So as I said, Eric has a site. It's runningwitheric.com, and you have to register, but it's free. And when you get in, you can find videos that show you proper running form. He's got videos that show lots of different exercises that are designed to help you build up the strength. You know, a lot of what it takes to run with proper form is a really strong core. And it turns out that you don't really need that strong of a core to be a pretty decent heel striker. You need really strong legs. And so building up your core as part of this program is something that's really important. He's also got a blog post that shows that provides a circuit training for strength. And so, you know, all these video exercises, he stitches them together into a little program that you can do in 25 or 30 minutes. And I've done this program once a week, once every other week when I'm a little bit busy, for a few months now. And I can definitely say that in addition to what it gives to you in terms of running, building up your core is definitely something that's worth doing in general, just for overall health. So, you know, that's kind of my story. I can tell you that, you know, I did learn my lesson from starting off too fast, and I also decided that maybe the ASICS Piranhas were a little too extreme, and so I abandoned those and got some New Balance 100s, which are really a trail shoe, but they're pretty minimalist as well. They've got a little bit more padding than the Piranhas, and they're a little stiffer than the Piranhas, so you don't have to use as much of your foot muscles. But you know, I love those, and I've been running on those now for about two and a half months. And where I'm at now is I'm up to, I think my longest run recently was about 14 miles, and I ran it in nine and a half minute miles, something like that, which isn't fast. I used to be faster. But the interesting thing was running that distance, number one, was easy, when I finished, I felt like I could have gone further. I felt like the only impediment would have been, you know, I needed to be eating and drinking a little bit more while I was running. But as far as muscularly speaking, it wasn't a problem. In the past, when I had gone for long runs like that, by the time I got finished, my quads would just be killing me. My legs would just be really, really tired. And so it was obvious that I was using a completely different set of muscles to do this. So that's kind of the part where I'm going to take a quick break here and get some thoughts together. And what I'll do is I'll play a song for you. This is by a friend of mine named Troy Staines, and the song is great. It's called She's Haunting Me. Got my notes organized. The thing that I learned the most from my first time through was maybe it's not a good idea to try to do this off the top of your head. I think I stumbled through it okay, but I think I'd rather be a little more prepared this time. So this segment, what I want to talk about now is I want to talk about the shoe industry. So there's a huge component of this book that talks about this idea that the running shoe industry is the reason why so many people are getting injured. So before I talk specifically about some of the things in the book, I do want to point out that I've looked around a lot and found a lot of information about barefoot running. This is a huge thing on the internet. You can look up barefoot running, look up minimalist running. There's a lot out there on this topic. And it's just like everything else in sports and just like everything else in music or computers, there are people who are diehards who believe that barefoot running is the only way to do it and that the shoe industry is this awful cabal of corporate interests that are conspiring to do us all in. And then there are people on the other side who say, you know what, this is just the next fad that's come down the line and it'll come and go just as fast as anything else. So my point of view on this is that we're somewhere in the middle. And what I mean by that is I don't believe that the shoe industry has been doing any of this on purpose. I think that they have been going with what they thought made sense to them, and I think there are probably reasons that make very, very good sense why you might want to have a really beefed up shoe with a lot of cushioning on it. I can certainly tell you that prior to doing this kind of running, I ran a lot faster than I do now. I used to be able to run sub 8-minute miles on training runs regularly, no problem. I never got injured. I did get shin splints when I tried to train for a marathon. I got up to my mile 21 workout, which is I think one or two before I was supposed to taper off and run the marathon, and I limped home with shin splints and didn't get to run again for about a month, and that was enough to swear me off of running marathons or long-distance runs like that. But I think that you can run pretty fast if you're a heel striker and you've got a big cushiony shoe and you're strong enough to be able to handle it. I don't know that I'll ever be able to run that fast again. I'm told that I will. I've actually asked in the forums on runningwitheric.com what people think of that and if they have transitioned and find that they're faster. And there are people who say, yes, you will be faster, but it will take a long time for you to get there. So I'm a patient guy, and I don't mind waiting. But I will say that even if I never get as fast as I used to be, the idea that I'll be able to run farther than I ever could run or run without injury as I get older and older, that appeals to me a lot more than going fast. I've never been fast enough to be somebody that was competitive in races anyway. I consider myself more of a diesel type of person, as in I get up to a speed and I can stay there, and I can stay there for a long time. So for me, being able to run in a new way that is going to allow me to do that for a longer period of time is something that appeals very much to me. But I will read you a very interesting piece that is corroborated by a study that was published on the internet recently, and what I'll do is put a link on my website to the study because it's great. It's a Harvard professor named Daniel Lieberman, and here's what he has to say. A lot of foot and knee injuries that are currently plaguing us are actually caused by people running with shoes that actually make our feet weak, cause us to overpronate, give us knee problems. Until 1972, when the modern athletic shoe was invented by Nike, people ran in very thin-soled shoes, had strong feet, and had much lower incidence of knee injuries. And the cost of these injuries? Fatal disease in epidemic proportions. Humans really are obligatorily required to do aerobic exercise in order to stay healthy, and I think that has deep roots in our evolutionary history. Dr. Lieberman said, if there's any magic bullet to make human beings healthy, it's to run. So, you know, there's a guy who's a Harvard researcher who, now he's a barefoot runner, so he's all about barefoot running, and I think that's, you know, that's his deal. As I said, I think there are some people who take it very, very seriously and go all the way to that extreme. I don't feel the need to go to that extreme, but I will say that within the programs that Eric Orton has on his website, he definitely recommends some training sessions barefoot, and I've done several of those. I've tried to do one once a week, once every couple of weeks if I can do it. Cold weather is a little bit of an impediment. It isn't that fun to go out and run on cold, wet grass in 35-degree weather. I've done it a couple times, and you get finished, and your feet feel like numb blocks of ice, and I wonder if that's actually good or bad for me. So the jury's out on that, but I can definitely tell you that running barefoot will be the fastest way for you to figure out what is the right form, because you cannot land on your heel running barefoot for very long. It hurts. It puts a huge, jarring feeling all the way up your body every step you take. So you will automatically adapt to the right running form immediately if you start running barefoot. I can promise you that. So let's move on into talking a little bit more about the shoe industry. So Christopher McDougall puts in what he calls his painful truths. And his painful truth number one is the best shoes are the worst. Runners wearing top-of-the-line shoes are 123% more likely to get injured than runners in cheap shoes, according to a study led by Bernard Marty, MD, a preventative medicine specialist in Switzerland's University of Bern. Marty's research team analyzed 4,358 runners in the Bern Grand Prix, a 9.6-mile road race. All the runners filled out an extensive questionnaire that detailed their training habits and footwear for the previous year. As it turned out, 45% had been hurt during that time, and the key factor was the price of their shoes. The cheaper the shoes, the fewer the injuries. So that's painful truth number one. Painful truth number two, feet like a good beating. As far back as 1988, Dr. Barry Bates, the head of the University of Oregon's Biomechanics Sports Medicine Lab, gathered data that suggested that beat-up running shoes are safer than new ones. In the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy, Dr. Bates and his colleagues reported that as shoes wore down and their cushioning thinned, runners gained more foot control. So how do foot control and a flapping old sole add up to injury-free legs? Because of one magic ingredient, fear. And this is my note, we do what it takes to not get injured. That's where good form comes from. And here's an interesting note on this. At McGill University in Montreal, Stephen Robbins, MD, and Edward Waked, PhD, performed a series of tests on gymnasts. They found that the thicker the landing mat, the harder the gymnasts stuck their landings. Instinctively, the gymnasts were searching for stability. When they sensed a soft surface underfoot, they slapped down hard to ensure balance. Runners do the same thing. Robbins and Waked found, just the way your arms automatically fly up when you slip on ice, your legs and feet instinctively come down hard when they sense something squishy underfoot. When you run in cushioned shoes, your feet are pushing through the soles in search of a hard, stable platform. And they quote, we conclude that balance and vertical impact are closely related, the McGill docs wrote. According to our findings, currently available sports shoes are too soft and thick and should be redesigned if they are to protect humans performing sports. So that's an interesting concept that, you know, you put more cushioning into the shoe and all of a sudden you're inviting injury. You're going to adapt. And this is an axiom, I think, that we need to take away from all of this, which is that we are serious adapters. We adapt to whatever circumstances we're in. When we put something on our feet, it causes us to adapt to that new situation. And if something on our feet is not allowing us to feel the ground, not allowing us to respond to the tiny intricacies of the ground, then those muscles that are there for that specific purpose, they atrophy. Just as if you put your arm in a cast for 8 weeks and then you take it out of the cast and you look at your arm and you look at what you can do with it, it's weak, it doesn't work very well. So what we're doing is we're basically taking the muscles in our foot, of which there are tons of muscles in your foot. Your foot actually has as many nerves as your hand and your face. So we're talking about a part of the body that is designed to really perceive the world and then give you the data that your body needs to respond to it. This is called proprioception. And proprioception is inhibited heavily by really thick shoes. So let's go into the third and the final painful truth. Even Alan Webb says human beings are designed to run without shoes. Before Alan Webb became America's greatest miler, he was a flat-footed frosh with awful form. But his high school coach saw potential and began rebuilding Alan from, no exaggeration, the ground up. I had injury problems early on, and it became apparent that my biomechanics could cause injury, Webb told me. So we did foot strengthening drills and special walks in barefoot and bare feet. Bit by bit, Webb watched his feet transform before his eyes. I was a size 12 and flat-footed, and now I'm a 9 or a 10. As the muscles in my feet got stronger, my arch got higher. Because of the barefoot drills, Webb also cut down on his injuries, allowing him to handle the kind of heavy training that would lead to his U.S. record for the mile and the fastest 1,500-meter time in the world for the year 2007. So there's painful truth number three. And this goes to the idea that barefoot is the be-all, end-all. And again, you know, I would encourage anybody that's thinking about anything like this, do not throw your shoes in the trash and go out and start running barefoot. Don't go buy a set of Vibram Five Fingers and start running barefoot, doing your same mileage that you usually do. You will injure yourself. It is a very bad idea. However, the concept of running bare feet or running in some sort of minimalist shoe, I think has a lot of merit. I don't think that barefoot, the extreme of barefoot is necessary, and I think you can get all of the benefits of running with proper form without going that far. But the barefoot thing is definitely out there, and it's something that's at least interesting to look into. I would definitely encourage you to Google barefoot running and look at some of the blogs out there. There's a lot of cool stuff on it. Another note that I have that's related to this that I just kind of picked out is pronation has become this very bad word, but it's just the natural movement of the foot. The foot is supposed to pronate. So to me, that's such an interesting statement because I've been running for years and I've been buying my shoes from specialty running stores for years. And when you buy your shoes from specialty running stores, what they do is they put a shoe on you, they take you out front, they watch you run, and then they come and say, okay, well, you pronate, so let's put you in this shoe, or you supinate, so let's put you in that shoe. The idea is their goal, their focus, is to get you to run straight. And the idea behind this whole concept of minimalist running is that your foot will naturally build up the muscles that it needs to be able to support your style of running. So pronating is not a bad thing. In fact, pronating is natural. If you run barefoot, you will find that you land on the outside part of your midfoot when you land, and then you roll in, and then your foot comes down, and then you step back up. So this, the premises that underlie all of the shoe industry are kind of flawed, I think. And here's another interesting piece. This is a quote that I think is just fantastic. It says, "Your foot's centerpiece is the arch, the greatest weight-bearing design ever created. The beauty of any arch is the way it gets stronger under stress. The harder you push down, the tighter its parts mesh. No stonemason worth his trowel would ever stick a support under an arch. Push up from underneath and you weaken the whole structure." Now that paints a really, really cool picture to me, because that's exactly what happens when you put on a big clunky pair of shoes. You're eliminating what you get from your arch. Now, the shoes that you can buy, the minimalist types of running shoes out there, they're all going to provide some level of support, but what they don't do is try to simulate, try to put something between your arch and the ground such that your arch doesn't have any role to play in your running. That is something that, you know, no shoe that you're going to be interested in if you're into good form is going to do for you. So, and there's another thing too that I want to throw out on this, which is that the running industry itself has tried to respond to this. You know, these Nike Freeze, which it's funny, before I ever got hurt probably 2 or 3 years ago, I bought a pair of them thinking they were really cool, and I bought them from the Nike store here in Atlanta, and the guy that sold them to me was this kid, and he said, "Look, you know, it takes a while to learn how to run in these shoes, so, you know, I would encourage you to not necessarily just go out and run your usual runs, do it slowly, adapt to it slowly." And being, you know, one of my bouts of acute idiocy, I went out that day, put those things on, and ran 10K in them. And I ran, and I took probably a minute and a half off of my usual time running a 10K. I was so excited. Now, I was running exactly the same style that I had always run. So basically what I was doing was I was running in a shoe that still had a pretty beefy heel to it, but didn't have anything else to it. So it didn't have any stability across the top. And I ran in these things for probably a month or a month and a half before I started having issues. And the issue was plantar fasciitis. So then I had plantar fasciitis, and it took me a long time to get over that. So it's definitely the shoe industry has responded, but what they haven't done is they haven't responded in a way, well, they're starting to. So let me back up and say that. But they haven't responded in a way that emphasizes form, emphasizes changing the way you run, until here recently. So New Balance has a set of shoes that are designed for midfoot to forefoot strikers. They're the New Balance 800s. And the whole deal with these shoes is that typically most running shoes you see, if you look at the amount of padding on the heel versus the amount of padding on the toe, there's a pretty steep angle there. So even if you try to run with proper form in a big, thick-heeled shoe, it makes it really awkward. It makes it very difficult to not land on your heel. So if you say that if you go out with the idea, "I'm just not going to land on my heel," it's really hard to do in a regular set of running shoes. So New Balance's 800s are still a fairly beefy shoe by my standards, but they're pretty flat as far as the angle of cushioning from the heel to the toe. So that's a pretty good shoe that you can try. In fact, I would probably recommend that as the starting shoe. Or there's another type of shoe that is out there. It's just really expensive. They're called Newtons, and the Newton shoes are the same kind of thing. They're pretty flat as far as the padding is concerned, but they're made specifically for midfoot striking. And there are some people out there that are doing really, really well in the triathlon world on Newtons. I think the guy that won Kona, the Kona Ironman this past year, the most recent one here in 2010 or 2009, was wearing Newtons. And so there's no question that some of these shoes are starting to make some headway. But the Newtons cost about $150 for a pair, which is a little bit too much coin for somebody like me to throw out on a pair of running shoes, especially for me, since I don't really care if they've got a lot of cushioning and a lot of padding. The New Balance 100s are great. I'm completely happy with them. Another option in the running shoe category, or the midfoot type running shoe category, is the Brooks Cascadias. These were designed by Scott Jurek, and he's, if you look him up, his last name is spelled J-U-R-E-K. he's pretty much the man in the ultra world. He's won all the major ultra marathon events. We're talking 100 mile, 100 plus mile races. He's won Badwater. If you've ever heard of the Badwater ultra marathon, it's about 135 miles through Death Valley. It's probably the most insane event that I can imagine. And so Scott Jurek was the designer for Brooks for these shoes, and they're great trail shoes designed specifically for midfoot running. And they've got a little bit more padding than the New Balance 100s. But the point is that there are some options out there. The shoe companies are realizing it, and they're starting to market around this concept. So time for another quick break while I get myself together on this third part, which is going to be kind of the evolutionary angle of this. And I think this is probably one of the coolest parts of it, too. I'm going to go back to the same song, and I apologize for doing this. I had uploaded three or four songs, but Blog Talk Radio didn't like them. I don't know if they thought that they were copyrighted or something like that. But anyway, so here's a little bit more of Mr. Troy Staines. I'd be happy to take some calls on this if anybody wants to call in and talk about, maybe tell me a story of your experiences with running, or if you have any questions about it, I'd be happy to take them and get a little bit of a conversation going here. I apologize for just talking the whole time. Anybody wants to call in, the number is 347-945-5419. And again, send me an email at ec@enlightenedstateman.com to let me know who you are and what you want to talk about. Ready to go into this third segment here. This is going to be about the evolutionary side of this entire Born to Run concept. And this, to me, is something that was hugely entertaining to read about. And it obviously resonated with me very much just because of my evolutionary kind of background and my, I guess, predilection for that kind of explanation, for things that look back and say, you know, how are we designed as human beings and how does that relate to what we're talking about here? So what I want to start out with is I want to give you a little bit of a context, I think, for a lot of what gets talked about in Born to Run around the evolutionary angle side of it. So bear with me. It's a little bit of a decently long quote, but I think it's interesting. So Christopher McDougall talked to a researcher named Dr. Bramble, and this is kind of what he had to say. So Dr. Bramble played the scenario out in his head. He imagined a tribe of primitive hominids, all squat, quick, and powerful, keeping their heads low for safety as they scrambled nimbly through the trees. One day, out pops a slow, skinny, sunken-chested son who's barely bigger than a woman and keeps making a tiger target out of himself by walking around in the open. He's too frail to fight, too slow to run away, too weak to attract a mate who will bear him children. By all logic, he's marked for extinction, yet somehow this dweeb becomes the father of all mankind while his stronger, swifter brothers disappear into oblivion. That hypothetical account was actually a pretty accurate description of the Neanderthal riddle. Most people think Neanderthals were our ancestors, but they were actually a parallel species, or subspecies, some say, that competed with Homo sapiens for survival. Competed, actually, as being kind. The Neanderthals had us beat any way you keep score. They were stronger, tougher, and probably smarter. They had burlier muscles, harder to break bones, better natural insulation against the cold, and the fossil record suggests a bigger brain. Neanderthals were fantastically gifted hunters and skilled weapon makers and may very well have acquired language before we did. They had a huge head start in the race for world domination. By the time the first Homo sapiens appeared in Europe, Neanderthals had already been cozily established there for nearly 200,000 years. If you had to choose between Neanderthals and early us in a last man standing contest, you'd go Neanderthal all the way. So where are they? Within 10,000 years of the arrival of Homo sapiens in Europe, Neanderthals vanished. How it happened, no one knows. The only explanation is that some mysterious X factor gave us, the weaker, dumber, skinnier creatures, a life or death edge over the Ice Age all-stars. It wasn't strength, it wasn't weapons, it wasn't intelligence. Could it have been running ability? Now, that's an interesting question. I tend to say that the reason is that we cooperated, our Homo sapiens were cooperators, and the Neanderthals weren't. And I think that all of the social things that had to develop in order to facilitate cooperation, all of our adaptations, our mental adaptations, were ultimately what led us to win. But nevertheless, it's still a very interesting question as to, you know, how our species ended up winning out. So Dr. Bramble went on and said, well, you know, if we test this hypothesis, how can we test it? How can we decide if this is actually the case? So what he did was he started looking at animals and separating them into two groups, the animals that were runners and animals that were not runners. And he studied them kind of in musculoskeletal terms. And he discovered that humans were definitely shared more of the characteristics of running animals than not running animals. Now, this is where it gets interesting. He said there are two kinds of great runners, sprinters and marathoners. Maybe human running was about going far, not fast. That would explain why our feet and legs are so dense with springy tendons, because springy tendons store and return energy, just like the rubber band propellers on balsa wood airplanes. The more you twist the rubber band, the farther the plane flies. Likewise, the more you can stretch the tendons, the more free energy you get when that leg extends and swings back. If I were going to design a long-distance running machine, Dr. Bramble thought, that's exactly what I'd load it with, lots of rubber bands to maximize endurance. Running is really just jumping, springing from one foot to another. Tendons are irrelevant to walking, but great for energy-efficient jumping. So forget speed. Maybe we're born to be the world's greatest marathoners. And you've got to ask yourself why only one species in the world has the urge to gather by the tens of thousands to run 26 miles in the heat for fun, Dr. Bramble mused. Recreation has its reasons. So this is kind of an interesting angle on it, right? I mean, the idea that not only do we share the characteristics of animals that run, but our characteristics are really oriented toward running far and not necessarily fast. And so he actually goes on and talks about how the difference between a human being and, say, a horse is astonishing. He says the horse has long legs and has four of them, but a human being has a longer stride. You can be a medium height, medium weight, middle of the pack runner, a perfectly average runner, but you have a longer stride than a horse. And the horse looks like it's taking giant lunges forward, but its hooves swing back before touching the ground. The result is even though biomechanically smooth human runners have short strides, they still cover more distance per step than a horse, which makes them a lot more efficient. So with equal amounts of gas in the tank, in other words, a human can theoretically run farther than a horse. And that turns out to be true. So McDougall is starting to home in on this evolutionary side of things, and of course the obvious question starts to come up, which is, okay, well, if running was our thing, how did it help us? What was the event? What was the advantage? What was the adaptation that was associated with running? And this is where, to me, the story gets really interesting. So here's a here's another quote. It says, the bow and arrow is 20,000 years old. The spearhead is 200,000 years old. But Homo erectus is around 2 million years old. That means that for most of our existence, for nearly 2 million years, hominids were getting meat with their bare hands. That's an amazing thing to contemplate, because I have always thought, or prior to reading this book, had always thought of humans as doing the deal where they get together and they trap a buffalo and run him off a cliff, or they spear him. You know, that was the whole essence of cooperation, is they were able to cooperate to kill. And now to see that, to read that they were able to kill, but not with any sophisticated tools, but with their bare hands, it begs the question, which is, how in the world could they possibly be doing this? And so Christopher McDougall started looking into this concept of persistence hunting. And this, to me, was super fascinating. I thought it was great to imagine, how in the world could human beings have been persistence hunters? And so basically, Dr. Lieberman comes back into play here, and it says, ethnographers' reports he'd read earlier began flooding into his mind. They told of African hunters who used to chase antelopes across the savannas, and Tarahumara Indians who would chase after deer until its hooves fell off. Lieberman had always shrugged them off as tall tales, fables of a golden age of heroes who'd never really existed. But now he started to wonder, how long would it actually take to run an animal to death? And luckily, Harvard has the best locomotive research in the world, so all the data Lieberman needed was right at his fingertips. He started punching numbers, and he came up with this. A jogger in decent shape averages about 3 to 4 meters a second. A deer trots at almost the identical pace. But here's the kicker. When a deer wants to accelerate to 4 meters a second, it has to break into heavy breathing gallop, while a human can go just as fast and still be in his jogging zone. A deer is way faster at a sprint, but we're faster over the distance. So this, to me, is a very, very interesting concept. And what he came up with when they studied it was that animals have the ability, the way that they cool themselves is by panting. So they're covered in fur and they pant, and that's how they cool themselves. But they get to a certain point where the panting is not doing the cooling, and they actually start to overheat. And when the animal overheats, the only thing it can do is stop. And I can actually attest to this. Those of you who are dog owners can probably attest to this. If you've ever been out with your dog, running, doing anything with your dog, when your dog overheats, what does it do? It completely stops. I remember going out for a run with my miniature schnauzer when I thought that he would be able to run, and we went for about 4 miles, and we got probably 2 miles into it, and he was doing great. And all of a sudden, he just sat down. He wouldn't run anymore. And I literally had to carry him home. It was pretty funny, because I'm totally sweaty. It's the middle of the afternoon. It's the summer. And I'm walking down the street with my miniature schnauzer, and I, you know, it took me probably 30 minutes to get home, and I had to haul him the whole way. Every time I put him down to walk, he wouldn't walk, and I just carried him all the way home. I thought I'd hurt him. And, you know, when I read this, that was the first thing that I thought about. It was a very, very funny thought. So this concept of persistence hunting basically says, you know, here's a human being. Human being is able to cool himself because he doesn't have fur. He's got thousands of sweat glands. The sweat comes out of his body and it cools him, so he's able to maintain a pace that doesn't overheat him. And so McDougall's homing in on it again. He finds a guy in South Africa. The guy in South Africa, now he had done a bunch of research prior to this trying to find people who are actually engaging in persistence hunting. And Lieberman did the same thing, was trying to find evidence of persistence hunting, but they couldn't find it. And it makes sense that they couldn't, because what would the fossil record show of a persistence hunt? Nothing. You wouldn't see a weapon. You wouldn't have any way of knowing that this ever happened. So it's all conjecture. It's circumstantial evidence that this was happening. Nevertheless, they kept looking for people who were doing this alive today, and they were not successful. They couldn't find anybody. And finally, this guy in South Africa stumbled across Lieberman and some of the research he was doing and said, hey, not only are there people here in Africa that are doing this, I've actually been on a persistence hunt with them. And so the book actually goes into this guy's experience. He had become friendly with the Kalahari in Africa, and actually learned their ways, lived with them, and learned how to persistence hunt with them. And he describes a story where he actually, they went out and they were hunting kudu, and describes how they tracked it and how they separated this one smaller, weaker one from the pack. And then after they separated him, they kept shooing him in the direction away from the pack so that they could keep track of him. And they tracked him, and they would get to spots where they couldn't see him. And these Kalahari would look at the ground to figure out where he went, and they would have to imagine in their heads how this was happening. And then they kept chasing him, and they kept finding him. They would lose him, and then they would find him. And they chased him down, and literally after several hours of doing this, they literally stumbled upon the guy, upon this kudu, and he was laying there, and he was literally drawing his last breath. And he talks about, it was a very sacred kind of moment. It reminded me a lot when I read it, or actually the movie Avatar reminded me a lot of this scene that I had read, where at the beginning of Avatar, when the woman kills the animal that's trying to get the main character, and, you know, he's all excited that it's dead, and she's very upset about it, and she goes into this kind of ritual of, you know, thanking the animal for giving its life, and the Kalahari did the very same thing. So, here you have real-life evidence of human beings doing exactly what these researchers theorized human beings had been doing forever. So I took that as, pretty decent circumstantial evidence that all of this made sense. So, I'm looking at the clock here, and I'm starting to run out of time, which is depressing, really, because I could talk about this for hours and hours. It's such an interesting topic. But I do want to try to summarize it and wrap some things up, which is to say that from a what can you do about this perspective, I'll come back to my cautionary note, which is if you think this is interesting, definitely take it slow. I would also recommend checking out runningwitheric.com, look into his site, watch his videos. If you want to get on one of his training programs, they're not expensive. He's a great guy, and he will definitely help you out. You can email him. I emailed him videos of myself running and said, hey, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? He got right back to me. So I think that having a coach, having somebody that can guide you through it is a great idea. Beyond that, I would say that, all of the other benefits that you get from something like this, like developing a strong core, is something that you carry with you in everything else that you do. So I am a strong proponent of it, and I think that everybody that I have talked to that I have cajoled into doing something like this, my wife being one of them, she got into it and, she was skeptical at first, and she's been doing it. She's had a lot of hip pain, a lot of problems in the past. And after making the transition, she loves it. And a lot of the pain that she was having, a lot of the back problems she was having, a lot of the knee problems that she was having are all gone. So I think there's something here, and I don't think it's a fad, and I don't think it's just a movement to try to discredit the shoe industry. I think the shoe industry has grown up legitimately, but it may have taken us in the wrong direction. So I didn't get a chance to get into the part about, are we sort of undoing our humanity, and is that good for us? So maybe I'll address that later on, or maybe in a blog post. So I think that's about a wrap. Let's see if there's anything else that I wanted to try to cover. They're telling me, it's funny, they tell me in my ear how much time is left, and they're saying 60 seconds. The woman is British, too. I love that. All right, so thanks for tuning in, and this will be available as a podcast on my website and on blogtalkradio.com as well. So thanks for joining. Is more